first chapter of Ruth. There's one aspect of that chapter that remains an open question. I'm going to deal with that question now. However, I have to tell you at the very outset, I'm going to give you a brief overview of one highly original and courageous approach to the question that I'm going to ask. And I'm just not going to be in a position to quote all of the sources necessary in order to make this absolutely crystal clear. And the chances are that if I would quote all the sources to make it crystal clear, we'll all be so confused. Won't make any difference. All right. You know what I'm talking about. You're already confused. Maybe you're already confused. It is a matter of great debate. Did Mahlon and Chilion marry Orpah v'Rut when they were in a state of being non-Jews? To put it as ugly as we can, did Mahlon and Chilion marry Shixus? And it's an open question. The Targum Yonatan ben Uzziel says quite clearly they were not Jewish. Rashi says they were not Jewish. There are other versions that say that they had undergone a process of conversion. Chas v'sholom, Mahlon and Chilion should marry Shixus. The Gemara says about that, and the Rambam quotes the Gemara, Mahlon v'Chilion was shnei gidolei hador, two giants of the generation. We're talking about great Torah scholars, pious people. The jury is out on the question of whether they married women who were not Jewish, or they did undergo, and when I say did undergo, I mean a proper conversion, Kedat Moshe Yisrael. So, let's assume the position. Let's go to Rav Shimon ben Yochai and Rav Yehoshua ben Karcha. In the Gemara and in Medrash, there are a number of opinions why were Mahlon and Chilion punished. We're talking terrible punishment. God caused them to die young. Rav Shimon ben Yochai, the spirit of Arkoma, the embers are still burning all over Eretz Yisrael. The air is polluted, and I was so thrilled to read in the Jerusalem Post this morning that the highest level of pollution was in, I would have thought Harnov, but it said Barkov. By the upper crust, you understand? The upper crust in Barkov, there was higher level of pollution than in Harnov. How do you like that?
Because it's a valley and
Harnov
is up there.
No excuses. It's one Harnov, nothing in Barkov. Shimon ben Yochai says, and this is what the Rambam quotes, that Mahlon and Chilion were two great people of their generation, and why were they so severely punished? Because they left Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz La'aretz. And the Rambam does point out that when there is a famine in the land, one is permitted to leave Eretz Yisrael and go to Chutz La'aretz. Listen carefully. There was a famine. So what do we want from them? So the Gemara says it, and the Rambam says it. It's not midat chasidut. The pious, though they have permission to leave Eretz Yisrael at the time of a famine, the pious, the chasid, the one who is machmer, would not leave Eretz Yisrael under those circumstances. So the Rambam says, and this is a quote from Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, the reason why Beit was because they left Eretz Yisrael and go to Chutz Laaretz. The question is, how does Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai know this? Maybe God. If you ask anybody who learns root, why were they punished? Do you know what the natural response would be? Because they married non-Jewish women.
Sure, they could.
Gedolim Hadorim married non-Jewish children. Even if they're not Gedolim Hadorim, Chumayim, Bethlehemians, go ahead and they marry Shemites. How does Rav Shimon ben Yochai know that they were punished because they left there? So it looks like, you know, it sounds like such a Zionist pshat coming from Rav Shimon ben Yochai. In other words, all the terrible avodas that they did, who cares? But they left there, it's a spoil, and they went to Chutz Laaretz. Rav Yehoshua ben Korcho says the reason why they were punished was, I'll read the words. Rav Yehoshua ben Korcho is the one who says, because he pilu libon shel Yisrael, I believe that's, yeah, I should have the exact words here. Omar Abchia Bar Ovin, Abchia Bar Ovin said in the name of Yeshua ben Korcho, Chas v'shalom, God forbid that Nachman ben Chilion would have left there at Yisrael at a time of famine. Afilu motzu soup in Oyotzuf, all that there would be left to eat was the chaff of the grain. Nachman ben Chilion would never have dreamt of leaving. V'l'v'neiman enshu, in other words, what it means is that the hunger was infinitely worse than that. There simply was nothing to eat, that's why they left, and they weren't punished for that. V'l'v'neiman enshu, they should have prayed for the generation, and they didn't. The prayers of Nachum V'chinyon may have been able to accomplish great things in heaven, and they didn't pray. Pray, tell me, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcho, why don't you think that they were punished because they married non-Jewish women? Do you understand what Rav Shimon ben Korcho comes out? I mean, this is another Rav Shimon ben Yochai all over again. The obvious that they married young Jewish women, and remember, we're talking about the weight of opinion, all those who hold that they married non-Jewish women. So that's the reason, because they didn't pray for their generation. There's a third opinion that says they were punished. Shehipilu libon shel Yisrael. They caused the heart of Israel to fall. In other words, it's a time of crisis. As long as we all stick together, it's okay. But the moment you see a great person jump ship, it sends a message of such despair to the Jews who are left behind. He's going to get, you know, he has his American passport, he's getting out of here. He's getting out of here. I remember this is a dilemma. When I was in Yeshiva, we had this dilemma. Often I was here in 55 and 56. If you think these are terrible times, and they are, those were pretty terrible too. It was the process, they hadn't created the word intifada yet, but they had created the word Fedayin. It was the Fedayin invasion. Every night Jews were being killed in different parts of Eretz Yisrael. The only thing that I don't understand about those years of Jews being killed, there wasn't a single settlement in the whole country. We didn't have Haravayit. We didn't have Yehudah Shomron. We were good little Jews in a little sliver of land. If you wanted to try to imagine where the Kotel was, you'd get on the roof of some building around here, and somebody would tell you, if you look 500 metrim, and imagine looking down 10, that's the Kotel. So I remember then the United States, about 3-4 times during the year, the American embassy notified all American citizens of the country that they should prepare for evacuation, and that the Sixth Fleet is arriving in Haifa, and all Americans should report to be taken out and rescued. So here I was in yeshiva in Palm Beach. Truth is, it didn't occur to me at all that I would say goodbye to my friends in the yeshiva. Bye-bye, boys. I got an American passport. I'm getting on the USS, who knows what. I'm going to the safety of the country. But anyway, just to be able to talk with our great Mashiach then, Rabbi Chestel Levenstein, great Babelusa. So we went past the Americans got together and said, Rebbe, listen, the American consulate embassy has told us to get ready to leave. So he says, it's too big a question for me to answer. I can't answer that question. But I can tell you one thing. If the Chazon Ish were alive, he would have said, never leave, because this is going to be the safest place of all. Which, of course, we didn't leave. Can you imagine what it meant? People who did leave. In a sense, it's destructive of the spirit. So that was the third opinion. But wait a minute. They married Shiksus. There is a fourth opinion in the Gemara that says they were punished because they married Shiksus. So we have four opinions. So four opinions. They left Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz Lars of Shin Bin Yochai. They didn't pray for their people. They, third, they caused despair. And four, they married non-Jewish women. So I had a Rebbe 40 years ago. Well, less than 40 years ago. When I was a student in Eretz Yisrael of Baltimore, I had a Rebbe by the name of Rav David Kronglass, the Chassid Lubavitch. He was a great Talmud Chacham and a very, very pious individual. He was a great Bar Musar. And I learned a great deal from him. So he has a Torah article in which he asks this question. And he makes an unbelievable analysis. I'm only going to tell you the brief outline of the analysis. But trust me, I can prove every step. And just you have to be careful not to make any far-reaching conclusions. Rabbi David says, number one, the Torah prohibition against marrying non-Jewish women is in the first instance related to the seven nations that live in Eretz Yisrael. There is a parasha, the Kanani, the Prizi, the Chiti, the Chiti, the Yusi, the Yerkoshi. They were the ones. Because it says in Torah, it's in Parashat Bet Hanan, Lo Tidchatein Bam. You shall not marry them. Your sons you shall not give to their daughters, and their daughters you shall not take for your sons. You know, no intermarriage. In that very same parasha, how does Rav David know that Lo Tidchatein Bam, you shall not marry, means only those nations? Because he says in that same parasha, that's about 4 or 5 psukim, there are 3 other halachot. There's the halacha of not to enter a covenant with them, you can't make a treaty with them. You shall destroy their gods. The Lo Tichanein, you shall not sell them land in Eretz Israel. All of those halachas apply only to the 7 nations. Therefore, he says, it's obvious that in that same parasha it says, you shall not intermarry with them, it means the 7 nations. It's still also to marry a shiksa, because the rabbis prohibited marrying any non-Jewish woman. And as far as we are concerned, a prohibition of the rabbis is just like the prohibition of Torah, makes no difference. But he discovers that there was a certain twilight zone for maybe a period of 1,000 years. And that twilight zone is a woman who's not from the Seven Nations, or for that matter, even if she was from the Seven Nations, but she achieves or acquires or takes upon herself the status of Ger Toshav. And I'll explain what that status is. There are non-Jews who are permitted, according to Halacha, to live in Eretz Yisrael. And the non-Jew can live here as a Ger Toshav. A Ger Toshav is not a Ger Tzedek. It's not somebody who's accepted upon himself the 613 Mitzvot. But there is the status of Ger Toshav, the one who accepts upon himself the 7 Noahide Mitzvot. You come on Aliyah, so first of all you start off as a, what? Well, there are those who come as tourists and remain tourists for the rest of their lives, and their children, grandchildren remain tourists, I understand. But then there are the legal law-abiding citizens like me who start off as a temporary resident, and then you become an A1, and then at some other stage you finally become the full-fledged citizen in this country. All right? In the movement from non-Jew to Jew, there is a station in the middle. One can remain at that station forever, or one can move from that station to the next. That's unimportant. Rav David says that Rut and Orpa became Ger Toshav. They accept the part of, huh?
How
could
they be Ger Toshav if they didn't exist that way?
No, Ger Toshav is a halachic status.
Of, yeah.
A halachic status has nothing to... One who is a Ger Toshav is also permitted to live in Eretz Yisrael, but a goy can be any place in the world, and as long as he accepts upon himself the 7 Noahide mitzvahs, he has the halachic status of Ger Toshav. But David discovers something else. And it really appeared about a month or two ago in Daf Yomi. There were a succession of laws that were promulgated by the rabbis. The last one was by the court of the Chashmonaim during the period of the Second Beit HaMikdash, which prohibited marriage with a Ger Toshav. Up until that time, one could marry a Ger Toshav. Is it the kind of shidduch? You understand? We're not talking about a Beis Yankiv Ger Toshav, but a Ger Toshav meeting Torah and mitin Rabbanon was mutter. Was it mitat chasidut to marry a Ger Toshav? No. Just trust me. I see you're so troubled. Smile.
And trouble for the children. What was the status of the children if their mother was a Ger Toshav?
So they go through the process that they can't be Jewish because she's not Jewish. Just give me 1 minute and... So Rabbi discovers that there was this halachic status, that was a status that existed most probably for about 1,000 years, at which there was such a thing as a Ger Toshav, and you can marry a Ger Toshav. Rav David even understands that, listen, there were no Jewish women to marry there. Man can't be expected to be without a woman. So that was the next best thing that they can do, which was not an Aveira, not an Aveira. But remember, we're still left, and here comes the tour de force. Here comes the main shot. Okay, they were Ger Toshavs. By the way, that also explains, according to those who hold that they had converted, but we first learned the process of conversion from the middle of the first chapter in Rut, where Rut says to Naomi, whither thou goest, I will go, your people are my people, your God is my God. That means it's only after Machmor and Chilion died that she converts according to her daughter. It's perfect. Because now she is converting from the status of Ger Toshav to the status of Ger Tzedek. It's fine. It's perfect. But we still remain with the great question. You have to listen to the answer to this. Still, how does Rabbi Yitzchak ben Yochai know that they died because they did not keep the Midah Chassidut, the piety of remaining in Eretz Yisrael, and they were put to death because they left Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz Laaretz? One thing is quite clear: to marry a Ger Toshav is not Midah Chassidut. Maybe that's why they died. So here comes this great chiddush. His great chiddush is for not fulfilling the Midat Chassidut, God doesn't punish that way, unless it's a Midat Chassidut where there is Chil Hashem, a desecration of God's name in front. They married Ruth and Orpah out there in the fields of Moab. Didn't even make it into Greer Faye Cashman's grapevine. That was unknown. But that they left Eretz Yisrael to Gedolei Hador, left Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz Laaretz. This was a Chil Hashem that reverberated from one part of Eretz Yisrael to the next. So Rav David says, they had transgressed two things that a really pious person would not do. They married Ruth and Orpah, and they left Eretz Yisrael. He says it's clear that the reason, or Shimon Yochai says the reason they were punished was because they left Eretz Yisrael. Because leaving Eretz Yisrael was Chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name. Marrying Ruth and Orpah was not. So you do trust me, that there always has to be a relationship of trust between teacher and student. I can prove every step of what I said, I can prove it. When I find that Rav David says, what Rav David says at the end of his essay is to me very, very fascinating. He says, yes, it's true. The Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel says they were put to death because they married Ruth and Orpah. So it's a difference of opinion. Obviously, if Shimon Mahoy holds not like that, and neither does Rabbi Yishuv in Karachar. But he says, you know what we learn from all of this? And he says that we learn from all of this something not in passing. I think it's not in passing. I think it's extremely significant. What we learn from all of this is that when Chazal, when a rabbi says something, you have to take it seriously. Because if you don't take it seriously, you're going to make a tragic mistake. And I'll explain exactly what he's referring to. There's a great debate that has been raging in Eretz Yisrael probably for the last 20 years. The debate has heated up in the course of the last year. How is one supposed to learn Tanakh? So there's one approach that is a classic Israeli approach. And it's going to be difficult for me to present both sides of the debate very objectively, because I am very clearly on one side of the debate. And here is a beautiful proof. There are those who say that the responsibility is to teach and learn Tanakh begova ha'inayim. The term is begova ha'inayim at eye level. Eye level means what I am and how I understand it. That's the way I'm supposed to look at Tanakh. I'll give examples in a moment. There's another approach to Tanakh that says, listen, the people who inhabit the Tanakh are people of such stature We cannot judge them in any way on the basis of our own feeling and our own approach. And I can give you a lot of examples that will leave you, I'll have to brainwash you afterwards. I remember, here I am in West Hempstead, minding my own business on Rosh Hashanah in the morning, and the Kriya Satora is about Avram being told by God to send away Hagar and Ishmael. He puts the boy on her shoulder, gives her a canteen of water, and maybe a disappoint, and she goes out into the desert, she wanders, and no water. She thinks they're both going to die. So wonderful, Rabbi, this is a patriarch. He sends her out with a canteen of water. He couldn't have sent her with water in a canteen of water. So therefore, he has already, in the middle of Kriya Satora, on the basis of the English translation of his Chumash, he has already arrived at the conclusion that Avraham Avinu, this pillar of Chesed, this is serious. Yehuda, you understand, commits a terrible act with Tamar, and he's yet the one who says, my, what terrible thing she did, send her out and have her burned at the stake. Of course, the Gova Ha'inayim people, the ones who know, I have to look at Tanakh the way I understand it. Right? Of course, when they come to David and Bathsheba, that's the field day. Then they go to work. Okay. They may never have learned one capital Tehillim. They don't even have an iota of the idea of the depth of David HaMelech's piety. And they got it all figured out. So I, of course, belong to the other school of thought. The other school of thought is, when you come to something like this, you better think long and hard. You have to begin with one assumption, that Avraham Avinu is Tzadik Yisod Olam. Avraham Avinu changed dramatically the entire face of this globe Ad Hayom Hazeh today. How often have I quoted Paul Johnson, the priest, in his epilogue to his History of the Jews? How a Goy describes not merely the contribution, but the revolution that was made by Avraham. And he says, maybe in the course of time, men would have achieved that. Then he says, no, chances are, we would never have achieved the knowledge that Avraham Avinu did. And this Avraham Avinu has changed the entire course of history. So you have to begin that you're not on the same level with Avraham. So you know what it does? It places upon you, therefore, a grave responsibility to attempt in some way to plumb the depths of his actions. And if you don't come up with something satisfying, your next responsibility is to say, I just don't get it yet. Maybe I'll get it in another few years of study. Anybody who's simply going to dismiss Dovin HaMelech, who knows how many other great in Tanakh. So Reb David says, if you really learn the story of Nachman and Shilom and go through it in the depth of halacha as he does here, and it's an amazing halachic analysis where he arrives at the conclusion that the marrying of Orpah and Rut was not prohibited at the time, neither rabbinically nor biblically. If you don't make this great analysis, You know what conclusion you will reach immediately? These guys were terrible. But Rav Shimon ben Yochai says, Machlon and Chilion were shnei gedolei hador, two giants of the generation. If the rabbis say they were two giants of the generation, you better believe it. And And therefore, if you can't achieve that kind of knowledge, you better learn and learn until you can. But you cannot learn Tanakh. I'm just coming to Tanakh, and it's me, and A, and Ike, and Jake, and I can judge that in whichever way I choose. I have to understand that these are figures that rise. But I went a little crazy earlier this year. I had not known about an article, but I became aware of it. What they do to Yosef and his brothers. In other words, it's bad enough that they sin, they made a mistake, and the Torah says it. But when these Govah Einayim guys get to work on it, you won't even recognize Yosef and his brothers. They turn into such horrible sinners. And you know, of course, the fallout of this is, I would never have done anything of the sort. Me? Harry Shakespeare. Wrote Arba. In other words, we begin to see ourselves as rising so much higher than the people of Tanakh. It's dangerous. It's awesome. So I said, here I got a hold of this article. Why didn't Yosef write a letter home? He's become the second in command to Pharaoh. Why doesn't he write a letter home? Pa, what are you going to post now? This is the postcard. Pa, how are you? I'm well, I'm fine. Regards to the whole family. So I'm not going to go into telling you my shot on that, which I think is very good. That's not the point right now. So somebody came up with this brilliant, brilliant approach. You know why he never wrote a letter home? Because Yosef had finally reached the point after a great deal of thought. He had a lot of questions. The biggest question that he had is, why did Father send me out there to see how my brothers are doing? That wasn't terribly smart of Father. Didn't he know how they feel about me? Now I get it, Yosef says. Father was in on the plot. He sent me out there so they should do me in. So what's the point in writing a letter to Father? He's not going to be thrilled when he gets that letter. He's going to say, oh shucks, we goofed the plot. Now, do you understand, can you imagine how upset I got when I read that? In other words, it's not bad enough that Yosef made mistakes and his brothers made mistakes. Now you know what we've done? We've thrown good old Yaakov into the whole business though. This is when you just learn Tanakh, free-falling study of Tanakh. You can't do that. There are rules. You have to know that you're not approaching a novel. You are dealing with Torah that is holy. You're talking about people that are giants, that we are incapable of in any way plumbing the depths of their greatness. So you have to approach it with a great deal of caution. Rav David is saying, if Rav Shimon ben Yochai, whose life and death we celebrated yesterday, said that these were Shnei Gedolei Ador, too great of a generation, you better believe it. So you have a question, how did Gedolei Ador marry Ruth and Orpah? So you better go back to the books and start studying. You cannot simply arrive at a conclusion that, well, you know, small people, small mistakes, big people, big mistakes. They're the only Ador, but they're going to sin. They're doing our favorite. Chelsea, that's bad. You can't arrive at such a conclusion. What you have to understand is where they sinned, or better said, where they erred. But you can't go ahead and simply say, well, these are two Gedolei Ador that just went ahead and Oh, the heck of it. They're going to marry Jesus. So he proved beyond any shadow of a doubt. Said, La Rocha, they will look at him. Was it the fine thing to do, the right thing to do? Under the circumstances, yes, but otherwise, no. But that's not why they're punished. They're punished for that which was a true Hashem. Leaving Eretz Yisrael at a time of crisis. That's a terrible, terrible true Hashem. Chapter 2. Let's get going when I come to the first pasuk in chapter 2. That I'll stay an hour on that pasuk. Yes, you got a question?
I had my team bring a high contact because of power deduction. Is there a reason that you can find? Or is there something that you find the answer to that?
That's a very fine question.
What was the question?
The question is, how does Rav Shimon ben Yochai know that? How does Rav Shimon ben Yochai know that? By the way, according to Rav David, it's not a question. Because according to Rav David, Rav Shimon ben Yochai knew all the halacha with regard to Rut and Arpa, and he knew that it could not be because of that that they were killed, so they had to make something else. Yes?
Why did the fourth one, the Omer, say that it was because they married?
Yes, so the Gemara brings.
Does the Gemara say that because he married Ruth and Orpah, or because it says that he married two people who were forbidden to
him? The opinion says because they married non-Jewish women. That's opinion number four. I mean, whichever way you want to put it, could be number one also. Said because of non-Jewish women. I start off by saying that the jury is still out. There are those who hold that they were non-Jewish shiksas, but obviously neither of Shin Ben Yochai nor of Yeshua Ben Korcha can say that. So the truth is, one of the things I wanted to do today was Zivak's view of the Gemara in Baruch Basra and go through the whole Gemara. That would have taken us till sometime around Hanukkah. So I decided against that. But they each bring Psukim. Yes?
It's not clear to me how they can be Tashat Ger if they still live in Moab. And they had no
children. That question was asked, right? And I didn't clear it in here. Ger Toshav is a halachic status. Ger Toshav is a halachic status. It's called Ger Toshav because a person that has that halachic status is permitted to live in Eretz Yisrael in a Jewish community.
But it wasn't known whether they would go to
Eretz Yisrael. Right. So I'm saying, Ger Toshav, according to the Chok HaShvut, a Jew in Kazakhstan who says he wants to be a citizen of the state of Israel, could become a citizen of the state of Israel in Kazakhstan. I know somebody with that status in the United States. Jonathan Pollard is an Israeli citizen, though he's rotting away in a looking at American prison. But what will go down in history as one of the worst acts of anti-Semitism of the United States of America. We don't come to the English. They're worse, but America's pretty bad. Okay. He has the status of an Israeli citizen, but he never set foot in Eretz Yisrael. A Ger Toshav is a halachic status. It says that this person, wherever he may be in the world, is fulfilling the seven Noahide mitzvahs, which now gives that person the right, should he choose to do so, he has the right to live in Eretz Yisrael in a Jewish community.
But he started out Jewish.
Who started out Jewish? I'm only using Pollard as an example of somebody who can have certain status even though he has not, in fact, taken advantage of the status. He is an Israeli citizen, but he didn't live here. A person can have a halachic status of Ger Toshav, a stranger who is also a resident. Resident doesn't mean, in fact, resident. Resident means one who has the right to residency in Eretz Yisrael. So Rut and Orpah can gain the right to residence in Eretz Yisrael by virtue of their status as Ger Toshav.
Would that apply to the Russians who are not Jewish and come here?
Oh, now you want me to comment justice, but that's one of our great problems today. That's the problem with Chok HaShvut. The only thing is, listen, anybody who reads Tanakh a little carefully seems to will obviously arrive at the conclusion that non-Jews are also going to join Jews in the coming of Aliyah. That's the way it is. Ezra and Nehemiah dealt with that problem, so we have the same problem. We're going to have to find a way to deal with it. That's it. It's one of those problems. Yes?
Could men from Moab or Ammon who kept the seven Noahide laws be considered in this category the way the women could?
Good question. Absolutely not. Because there's a clear pasuk in Torah that says, Lo yovo Ammoni u'mo'avi b'kahal Hashem, and Ammoni and Mo'avi can never become part of the people of Israel. Could they have the ger toshav status that might give them permission to live in Eretz Yisrael? Could be. I'd have to investigate that. I wouldn't. That's the whole question that happens over the whole Sefer. Boaz is going to make the clear the declaration that the only ones that were prohibited from Ammon and Moab were the males and not the females, which of course brings us in to the second chapter. And I'm going to spot it now. Nobody is going to stop me. Well, not only Modar, not only had a Modar, Licky Shop. Let's use Modar as friend. It could be friend, it could be mishpucha, family. Not only had, it really means both. I mean, that's a terrific thing. When friend is family too, or maybe even more exciting is when family is friend too, that's not always so. But here it's both in one. Ula Naomi Moda Leisha, a friend family of her husband, Ish Gibor Chayo, a man who was mighty, Mishpachat Elimelech from the family of Elimelech, Ushmo Boaz, and his name was Boaz. The word Moda is read Moda, but it's spelled Mem Yud Dalet Ayin, not Mem Vav Dalet Ayin. So I saw one of the Mefarshim who says that in this strange spelling is the question that has to be answered in this chapter. Men Yud Dalet Ayin can be read Mida, who knows, or Miyo Dea, who knows. Now the question is, who knows whether Boaz is a friend? Do we know? What don't we know? Because it means something very strange. Here are Ruth and Naomi, they're back in Bethlehem. We have no indication that any member of the family has come cold. We don't have any indication whether anybody on the block came in and said, hi, you're new in the neighborhood? You need something to eat? What we are going to learn from this chapter is that without anybody saying a word, Ruth and Naomi are ostracized. Nobody talks to them, nobody speaks to them, nobody communicates with them. They are the pariahs of the community. Because Bethlehem has not forgotten the day or the night that she left with her family. When they abandoned Bethlehem, they haven't forgiven her. We would think that now that they can take a look at her and see her empty of everything, that God has already punished her. Who knows in how many homes they have cursed the name Elimelech and the name Naomi and Machpel Mishayon. We have to stay here, and we're going to stay here. We're not going anyplace. And they left. This was a terrible blow to people. There's no question about it. They return to Bethlehem. Nobody only communicates. So Miodea, who really knows whether he is whether he's a friend or he's not a friend? That's the question that's going to be answered in this chapter. What kind of word is moda? So this is something that we have spoken about in the past, I think not for a long time now. There's a great Rashi. This is not to mean that there are any Rashis that are not great, but there's a super great Rashi that really has such ramifications. In Parshat Vayeda, it says, when God is preparing to destroy Sodom and Amorah, so he says, am I going to conceal this from Avram? I've given him this land, and now I'm going to destroy four cities. So God says, Ki yidati, because I know him. Leman asher yitzave es bonav es beis avachol. I know that he's going to command his family and his friends after that they're going to keep the way of God. So Rashi says, what a great Rashi. Rashi says, Yidartiv, I know him. Ahavtiv, I love him. Lishon Chiba, it's a term that expresses affection. Kamo, and of all things, what pasuk does Rashi bring? In Parshat Vayeda, Moda L'Isha. How about it here? Hello, Boaz, Moda Teinu. And we're going to come to it appear a second time in chapter 3. Boaz is our good friend, the one who loves us. Va'anam, then Rashi makes the great covenant. This is all great so far. Then Rashi says that the real meaning of the word to know is really to know somebody. And Rashi defines Shaham Khati this Odam, if you really love somebody, Mekarvoes, or you bring him close, Viyodo, and you know him, Umachido, you recognize him. In other words, to know is to love. To know is to love. The word Yidiyah therefore means to love. Which of course has so many ramifications. For example, of course, the first instance is V'ho'odom Yoda, the Chava Ishko, and man knew his wife, the Chava. So, of course, people have always sort of understood this as meaning, you know, Torah doesn't talk about sexual relations like that. So they use a euphemism. And the euphemism, you know, and Adam knoweth his wife is evil. Because we can't say things out as they should. Torah, by the way, is pretty clear and says things as they are. What they've lost completely is that in this first relationship between Adam and Chava, Torah is defining the meaning of love. It's not merely something carnal and sexual. It is to know somebody, to come close to somebody. Love equals yediyah, and yediyah equals love. After that unusual visit of Elkanah and Chana to Shiloh, and they return home, so it says in Elkanah Yoda et Chana Ishta, Elkanah knew his wife. We know what they did. But you know what the prophet is telling us? He didn't know until that day in Shiloh, when they come, and she cries bitterly, and he says to her, Chana, lama tifki, why do you cry? V'lama lo tokli, why don't you eat? And then he says this great, noble statement of all, Havo anokhi tov lach me'asor abonim, I'm better to you than 10 sons. She stops crying. She doesn't want to upset him. She sees that his crying is upset, but you know what she just now learned? She just now learned that after all these years, he doesn't begin to understand her. If he's able to say to her, I'm better than 10 sons, than 10 children, he doesn't have a clue as to the depths of her need for a child. Which of course turns out to be a great blessing. Because then she knows, finally knows, she comes face to face with the truth, that the Gadol HaDor, the great man of the generation, is not going to pray for her. He's given up hope. He has despair. And then she knows it depends completely on me. And she turns to God and she prays like nobody ever prayed before. And that's why we learn the laws of prayer from Hannah. And when he comes home, Elkanah Yoda, he had learned something about the depth of her need for a child and her great piety. He never really knew his Hannah as he knew her now, and therefore he never loved her as much as he loves her now. So the word Yedi'a, used as the word for love, is not some kind of euphemism so we shouldn't have to talk in physical terms. It's the essence of the nature of the relationship which is being described. So when Naomi has a friend, Mishpucha, of her husband, Yishkibrachaya, in Mishpucha del Noah, and his name is Boaz, Atomer Ruth HaMoavir, Naomi, Ruth HaMoavir says to Naomi, Elchumon HaSod, let me go to the field, Ba'lakto HaShibolim, and I'm going to gather from the sheaves of grain, Achar HaSher, and so angry enough, following the person who might find favor in his eyes, Atomer, and she said to her, L'chibiti, go my daughter. We'll have to leave next week a description of the halakhic process taking place over here. Because there are all sorts of things that fall or drop or are forgotten in the field that the poor are permitted to take. It's like their own. Here is not only, you understand, from this wealthy home, and Ruth, the princess, the daughter of Eglon, king of Moab, have now joined the lowest level of the economic strata. That ain't nothing lower. And most probably, when it says that Ruth HaMoavia, why is she described as a Moavia here? Don't we know that already? It may be, just imagine, they have nothing to eat. They're sitting at home. Nobody knocks. Nobody comes to visit. Ruth blames herself. She says she thinks to herself that everything is happening to Naomi because of me. They're just not ready to accept the Shiksa who has converted. She may have some idea that maybe there are Jews who also don't want anything to do with Naomi because Naomi had abandoned them. But she feels that it's her responsibility. And because it's her responsibility, she feels that she is the one who should go out and gather grain in the field. It must have been a difficult decision until she finally said it. And Naomi was not the one that wanted to broach the subject, but it reached the point that there was nothing else that they could do. So she says, L'chi biti, go my daughter. Batelech hatoro. Oh, what two beautiful words. I would love these two words when I come to them. I love it. Batelech. She went. Shatoro means she came back. Well, wait. But the passage goes on that she begins gathering grain in a field. Batelech hatoro. She gathered grain in the field after the harvesters. By he carried me to their home. What a interesting two words. And it happened, me to their home. It just so happened. The first field she went into. She doesn't have a clue. No, what the Pasuk is letting us in on now, she doesn't know. But the first step that she has made out of the house in Bethlehem, the Hashgacha, the divine providence, is working over time. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if the relations waiting up there in heaven When is Ruth going to finally walk out of the house? Because God is only going to help those who help themselves. And the moment she gets out there into the field, the Levitian says to his angels up in heaven, guys, this is it. We're going to work now. All these steps that our daughter has planned, not only for Ruth, for Dor HaMelech, for Klal Yisrael, for Mashiach, there's not much time left. Boaz is not going to live much longer. There's not much time left. I'm telling you, when she starts walking on the road, there must be great joy in heaven. The journey of history has begun. But wait a minute. Why does it say Vatelech Vatovo? This is something we can always have. She went and she came back. When we go someplace that we don't know well, we keep looking back to say, three blocks. There's a bank, I live at the corner, one corner, and a bank is right at the other corner. There's a pious guy over here, you know? You walk and then you trace your step back. You ever notice driving someplace you never went before? How long it takes to get there and how quick it is to go back. Okay? I'm telling you, she's very hesitant. She doesn't know where she's going. She may not be able to find her way back through the fields. The Gemara says, also Simonio, she made signs. Most probably she had a little Swiss Army penknife with her. And what she had learned in the Girl Scouts, she was making signs. So she went, and she came back. She went, and she came back. Is there also another hesitation? It's going to be difficult for her to walk into that first field and present herself to somebody who's absolutely poverty-stricken and penniless, and she's going to have to stop. The princess is going to start picking up grain from the field. The Vatelech and the Vatovo, I therefore say, represents, first of all, yes, her hesitation, and that she is taking steps to make sure that she makes her way back, and it also represents the emotional and the intellectual hesitation. She's coming and she's going, and she finally takes the step of going into the field. And she doesn't have a clue. She still is going to have a long day until she begins to see a glimmer of hope. But we know already that the Rebbeinu Shlomo is working 24 hours a day. And how beautiful it seems, you know. It just so happens. Ha ha ha. Vayikar Mikidel. What an interesting word to use. You know who else used a word like this? Eliezer, when he comes to Padan Aram to find a wife for Rivka. So he prays to God, Hakrei Nolifonai Adel. Make it happen before me today. Now, usually the word mikideh would seem to be precisely the opposite of divine providence, Hashgachah providence. But what it means in this context is, coincidentally, nobody else is involved. There's nobody else here. It's something that happens all on its own. It can't be attributed to any other person, being, or power. This happenstance, circumstance, is all God's work. Nobody is in the middle. There's nobody who comes up there and says, listen, if you're looking for a field, I know a field. There's a nice fellow there. Boaz, you want? I can talk to Boaz for you. And I'm, well, second cousin, daughter married my third cousin, son. I know. There's no protection. There's no nothing. She just walks into the field. And that's the field of Boaz. And of course, from this point on further, great things are going to begin to happen. Later, I hope to remain silent for a week. Okay.
Rabbi Goldberg.
Yes.
The placement of the sentences, wouldn't it have made more sense that it would have been first, that they only told her to go to the field. And then Peleg was to vote, and it happened to be the field of a relative Boaz. Instead of introducing the fact that Boaz was a relative.
What can I do? I think that the way the parent has it is better. In other words, we are told in this first passage, we're given the clue. In other words, we, the reader, know everything that's going to happen now. I don't know, but we have to know that the central figure is going to, the two central figures of this parent are going to be Boaz and Ruth, for that matter. It's going to be Boaz and Ruth from here until the end of the. Until the end of the Sefer. Think about it. Look at the bill. I do it very often. I read Sukkot 10, 15 times until they go into the Kishkes. When they're in the Kishkes,
I'm going to try to find you.